Okay, welcome back to our Jewish history series. Just a programming note. Next week is our last session for the Zman, for the semester, which will, be interrupted by Pesach. This class will continue after the Pesach break. If you want to re-register for it, I would encourage you. We didn't cover quite as much ground as I had hoped because we got into a lot of very interesting topics, and I want to continue the discussion about the march towards modernity, and to cover some other topics like the response to some of the things that we're talking about now, particularly the Haskalah and the Enlightenment topics, such as the emancipation of the Jews being granted citizenship in the European states, and some of the kickback to that, issues related to the rise of Zionism, anti-Semitism, the establishment of the State of Israel. Those are some of the things that I hope that we'll get to as we as we move along. Next week, North America, I don't know about Europe, next week North America will have changed your clock to daylight saving time, and so you'll only be in New York, you'll be 6 hours behind Jerusalem, Hawaii, Chicago, etc. You have to do the math for yourselves, meaning you'll be 1 hour less, but I'm going to give the class next week at the regular scheduled time, which is 10 p.m. in Jerusalem, and it'll be 4 p.m. in New York instead of 3 p.m. And again, just adjust accordingly. So please adjust your schedules accordingly. I want to focus on last week. We had a kind of overview of things related to the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment, particularly the personality of Moses Mendelssohn. I want to talk specifically tonight about I want to look carefully at two different documents. The Edict of Tolerance of Joseph II. There's good old Joseph on the screen. How come all these people from the 18th century look like George Washington? Why is that? Well, no, in other words, George Washington looks like a typical 18th century gentleman. It has something to do with these clothings and the powdered wigs or whatever it is. Hold on, let me just look. There's some chats that have come in I want to pay attention to. Yeah, really? There's no daylight savings time in Hawaii? Because you have daylight all the time. Is that it? That's cool. Didn't know that. Joseph II is the Holy Roman Emperor. There's a homework assignment. The Holy Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. Discuss. He's the king of Germany. That's what it means. Although he controls other parts of Europe as well, what we today call Austria and other parts of Europe, he lives from 1741 to 1790, and he's ruling from I think 1764 and onward. He was a very enlightened monarch. If we're talking about the Enlightenment, then this is it. This is the enlightened monarch. Now, enlightenment comes in many different formats and with many different motivations, which are not mutually exclusive, and we'll see that in a second. In 1782, he issues this Edict of Tolerance, which is an attempt to encourage the Jewish population, I don't want to say the Jewish citizens, but the Jewish population of his kingdom to get with the program, to modernize, to get modern. Remember, I think we made this point in our opening session, that modernity, it's always, you're always living in the modern period. You know, it's, even if you're making your fire by rubbing two sticks together, you're modern man. Whenever you're living, you know, no matter where you go, there you are. No matter where you, no matter when you live, it's the modern period. So it's an attempt to kind of get with the program, trying to get the Jews to get with the program, but with a recognition that there needs to be some kind of encouragement on the part of the powers, on the part of the powers that, on the part of the powers that be. In this edict, he mentions the following. Our subjects, without distinction of nationality and religion, once they have been admitted and tolerated in our states, shall participate in common public welfare, the increase of which is our care, shall enjoy legal freedom, and not find any obstacles in any honest way for gaining their livelihood and of increasing general industriousness. So he's very frank from the outset. What's his purpose as monarch, and what role do the subjects play in that vision of what he's trying to promote? This paragraph here. What's the agenda here? Yeah, well, in other words, Sherry states public welfare, strong economy. I would flip that around. In other words, if there's a strong economy, so then the crown can be generous about providing for the public welfare. And then he points out and he admits, since, however, the laws and the so-called Jewish regulations pertaining to the Jewish nation, that's an interesting, I don't know, obviously we're reading this in translation. I'm not sure what the German term, this Nation, I don't speak German, I don't know what this means, but the Jewish nation is obviously, the term doesn't mean what we mean by nation. There's no sovereignty. It probably means the Jewish people, the collective of the Jews in the, you know, under the crown, prevailing in our hereditary countries, are not always compatible with these, our most gracious intentions. So there's this very candid admission up front that the way that we treat the Jews, we, I'm speaking in the voice of the crown, the way that we treat the Jews, or the way that we sometimes discriminate against them through the Jewish regulations, through the laws that govern how Jews can be treated and what rights they have and what permissions they have, there's a disconnect. These conditions that we keep the Jews in don't always enable them to meet their economic potential. And therefore we hereby amend them by virtue of this present edict. So this edict of tolerance is about trying to create a situation in which the Jews can be more fully integrated in and more productive in terms of the economy. Chaim, you ask about the word nation. I just commented on that a moment ago, I think, while you were logging on. Right, so correct. So the tolerance is not at all altruistic. It's certainly motivated by a certain self-interest, but that in and of itself is a very there's an enlightened aspect to it, considering how Jews had been treated up until then. I remind you of the story, the perhaps apocryphal story of Moses Mendelssohn's entrance to Berlin. You know, Jews were allowed to enter, you know, only through one gate, and it was the same gate that swine and cattle were allowed to enter through. So there's a real, you know, even though this is not about a notion of, you know, all men are created equal and endowed with certain inalienable human rights, it's also a real change in orientation. And then essentially what we have in this document is you don't have the full text here. It's been abridged, but basically it's a list of certain changes that are going to take place in the way Jews are governed, as well as certain expectations of what the Jewish community is going to have to do in order to, you know, kind of be worthy of these new conditions. So he mentions that it's our goal to make the Jewish nation useful and serviceable to the state, mainly through better education and enlightenment of its youth, as well as by directing them to the sciences, the arts, and the crafts. So the agenda is to open up education to the Jews and to thereby enable them to enter professions that have been closed to them until now. Tolerated Jews may send their children to the Christian primary and secondary schools. By Christian, they mean what we call public schools, which were at this time Christian schools. Jews can go to school. Now, Jews didn't go to school. They went to cheder. There were private schooling institutions of the Jewish community, but they didn't gain general education. So Joseph II says they should learn the opportunity for reading, writing, and counting, reading the three R's. With regard to schools of higher degrees, which were never forbidden to Jewish coreligionists, we hereby merely renew and confirm this permission. So, but Lemaisa, technically speaking, Jews were not able to attain higher education. There were very, very few opportunities for Jews to attain higher education and to use higher education, to apply higher education, with the possible exception of medicine. Jews, you know, often had the opportunity to study medicine and to practice medicine, but besides that, other professions were not open to them. Here, number 10. Hold on, let me just scroll down. We're going to allow Jews to prepare the necessary ways of gaining a livelihood. So therefore, we hereby most graciously permit them to learn. Permit them from now to learn all kinds of crafts or trades here as well as elsewhere from Christian masters, certainly also amongst themselves, and to this end apprentice themselves to Christian masters to work as journeymen, and the latter may accept them without hesitation. In other words, the main way people were trained in various crafts was to apprentice yourself to a master and to learn how to be a printer, how to be a carpenter, how to be a smith, a silversmith, how to be a, you name it. So now we're going to allow them to apprentice themselves to Christian masters and to study and then to enter those fields. Now, this is something that's liable to be objected to by Christians. Why? Why might Christians object to this? No. Who stands to lose by this? Is somebody raising their hand? Let me see. No. Right, because in other words, it creates a more crowded field. This was part of what the whole guild system in Europe was like. It was to exclude people from entering trades, or to limit the amount of people that could enter trades, and in order to cut down competition. And Jews were largely excluded from this, and now they're allowed into it. However, we see here in number 11 that the Jews can carry all types of trade without, however, the right of citizenship and mastership from which they remain excluded. And this is very significant. Number one, Jews can apprentice themselves to masters of trades, to learn professions, but they themselves cannot become masters. And two, they are still not citizens. They are not granted citizenship. They are not full members of the polity. They're not full members of the society with all the rights thereunto pertaining. Correct. They're, in other words, by not becoming masters, their pay scale is still limited. And most significantly, and this is the key line, they're not citizens. The Edict of Tolerance is not an edict of emancipation. They are not being granted the status of full members of the society. But we're beginning to open the gates. Let's move on a little bit quicker here. Let's look here at number 15. Considering the numerous openings in trades and manifold contacts with Christians resulting therefrom, the care for maintaining common confidence requires that the Hebrew and the so-called Jewish language and writing of Hebrew intermixed with German shall be abolished. So since we're interested in creating a kind of space in which Jews and Gentiles can interact in a more meaningful way, I'm gonna come to the chats in a second. Let me catch my breath here. Since we want to create an even playing field, so we're trying to strongly discourage the use of Hebrew and more so the use of Yiddish, what he calls Hebrew intermixed with German. To abolish the use of Hebrew and Yiddish, obviously not to the idea that, you know, in your own home you wouldn't be able to speak in whatever language you choose, but that we have to make them fluent in German. Now, this was one of the main agendas of the earlier notion of promoting a school system and promoting general education for the Jews so that they could speak German. The idea being that the Jews were very suspect if they kind of had this secret coded language of their own. And if they're going to enter the marketplace on equal footing or on semi-equal footing, so then we all have to be speaking the same language so that there isn't this sense that the Jews are, you know, kind of conducting things on the side. So I'm just looking at. Oh, I see that Roxanne answered Sherry's question in the meantime, that among the main advantages of citizenship were land ownership, but not just land ownership, but the right of residence. If you owned land, then you could live on it, but if you didn't own land, you still at least were entitled to live in the country. And a citizen is allowed to live, you know, with certain discretion, anywhere in the country that he lives, anywhere in a country that he is the citizen of. But if you're not a citizen, so you can't necessarily live any place. The Jews are restricted on where they can live. How many Jews can live in a city? Special taxes have to be paid in order to be given entrance to places, etc., etc., etc. Those are among the things that not being full citizens, those are restrictions that would still apply. These tolerated Jews, meaning Jews who gain education and are contributing to the greater common weal, so they have certain privileges. In terms of Jewish housing, this is what he talks about in number 18, in number 19, about certain head taxes that would be abolished. Look here at number 25, in article 25. Since by these favors we almost, the key word being almost, place the Jewish nation on an equal level with adherents of other religious associations, an aspect to trade and employment and civil and domestic facilities, we hereby earnestly advise them to observe scrupulously all political, civil, and judicial laws of the country to which they are bound, as all other inhabitants, just as they remain subject with respect to political and legal matters of the provincial and municipal authorities, etc., etc., etc. Here's the real turn. This is we're almost making them full people. We're being very, very, very generous. We're going to remind them they have to behave themselves. They have to behave themselves. Chaim, you ask about Latin being abolished. No, Latin wasn't abolished, but Latin wasn't used by general tradesmen. Latin was still, you know, a church language. Certain scholarly people, academic types, would know and study Latin. No, Latin was used for other things, but that wasn't. In other words, Latin wasn't used as a kind of private language of any one group to the exclusion of others that might have caused some kind of a trade imbalance. So, what's the Jewish response to? What's the Jewish response to all of this? That comes from this fellow, from Naftali Hertz Wiesel, who's known in English as Hartwig Wesley. Wiesel is Wesley, Hartwig, Hart and Naftali, right, are the same thing. He lives from 1725 to 1805. He was a poet. He was an epic Hebrew poet, and was really one of the pioneers of Hebrew writing in the early Haskalah, which will ultimately lead to the revival of Hebrew at some point in the future. He's a philosopher. After Mendelssohn, he's probably the next best known and most significant of the Maskilim. He had a traditional upbringing. He studied with Rabbi Yonatan Eibschitz. And he had a very positive response to the Edict of Tolerance, and he writes a work called Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, The Words of Peace and Truth. This is the title page. It's written in 1782. It's written the same year that the Edict of Tolerance is issued. Here's the title page. Divrei Shalom Ve'emet. It's written in Hebrew, which is significant. Since it's written in Hebrew, we can probably assume that his target audience is the elite, the Jewish elite, the Jewish intellectual elite, which is essentially the rabbinic crowd, other fellow maskilim, but it's not written for consumption by the masses who really would not be reading Hebrew on the level that it's written. Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, Lekal Adat Yisrael, the community of the Jewish people, Hagarim Ba'artzot Memshelet HaKesar HaGadol, HaOhev Et Bnei HaAdam, UMishamshat UMisamach Et HaBriot, Yosefus HaSheni Yarum Hodo. Words of Peace and Truth, addressed to the Jewish people living in the kingdom of the great Caesar. The Jews referred to the king of Germany, the Holy Roman Emperor, as the Caesar, the Caesar, the lover of mankind, and the one who causes the creatures to rejoice, Joseph II, his Majesty Joseph II, by Naftali Hertz Wiesel. This is the title page. This Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, right? Kaiser in German is Kaiser in German is it's well, it's from Latin Caesar. More wigs, yes, more wigs, or at least curlers. Divrei Shalom Ve'emet. Does anybody catch the title, the reference to that title? What that's from? It's in Yone de Yoma. So Chaim, if you cheated, at least tell us what it is. No? Okay, so here it is. It's a pasuk at the end of Megillat Esther. Here's the pasuk. V'yishlach svarim el kol ha'yehudim el sheva ve'esrim u'me'a medina malchuta chashverosh. That at the end of the story, at the end of Purim, at the end of the Megillah, they send out a letter, the recording of all the proceedings to the 127 kingdoms, the 127 provinces in the kingdom of Ahasuerus, Divrei Shalom Ve'emet. And this proclamation is called the words of peace and truth. L'kayem et yimei ha-purim ha-ele bizmaneihem kasher kiyem aleihem Mordechai Yehudi v'Ester Malkah v'kasher kimu al nafsham v'alzaram divrei hatzemot v'zakatam. Right, so that the instruction that in future generations they should celebrate Purim. So that letter, that instruction, this kind of proclamation is called Divrei Shalom Ve'emet. Why he chooses this as the title, we'll see in a second. But it's a programmatic essay by which he is trying to make an argument that the Edict of Tolerance is a really good thing, and we the Jewish people stand to benefit from, again, to put it in our modern slang, why it benefits us to get with the program. Let me just skip ahead a drop. Again, all of these documents are available on the website. You can look through them more carefully on your own. But he makes this point. Since what was liable to be most threatening? What was liable to be most threatening to the Jews in the Edict of Tolerance? What do you think the traditional Jewish community would be most resistant to? Right. So Sherry points out modern education, what we call secular education. What we call secular education was very threatening to the traditional community. And that question, and this is really why I'm spending so much time on this, because it's going to become a central issue throughout much of the rest of Jewish history, our relationship to what we call secular studies. Let me just make a side point before I look at Rafi's comment in the chat. That I'm going to use secular studies, even though I think it's the proper term, but probably not because it's been misappropriated. Secular, I mean, we talk about Jewish studies or versus secular studies, or in Hebrew we talk about Limudei Kodesh and Limudei Chol. Chol being secular, like we say in Havdalah, Hamavdil bin Kodesh Lechol. But sometimes it takes on a pejorative sense, the term secular. The word secular, if we're talking about Latin, Chaim asked about Latin earlier. I proudly studied Latin for a bunch of years, a long time ago. But one of the things that I do remember is that the word secular means the world. In the United States dollar bill, there's the slogan on the seal, "Novus Ordum Secularum," a new world order. Secular means the world. So when we talk about secular studies, we mean the study of the world, of olam hazeh, of this world, of the physical world, the study of sciences, the study of history, the study of mathematics, etc., etc., etc. So I'm going to use that term, secular studies. I think that's a good term, secular, because secular studies deals with olam hazeh, and Jewish studies or Torah studies deals with, well, it deals with a lot of different things, but we might say it deals with olam haba, you know, or it deals with olam hazeh, but has an olam haba focus. Let me just look at what Rafi wrote here. Yeah, about the emancipation leading the way to assimilation. Yes, that's true, and that was the great fear. You hear talk about the Baal HaTanya. We'll get to that in a subsequent discussion. The way the Haskalah played itself out in Eastern Europe, in Russia, was a little bit different than the way it played itself out in Western Europe, in Germany, and it comes in a subsequent phase. So I'm going to hold off on that till later. So Wiesel, addressing his fellow Jews, says, in order to educate the youths of Israel, that's a significant term. By Israel, of course, he doesn't mean Eretz Yisrael. He doesn't mean the state of Israel, which is far off in anybody's dream. He means the Jewish people. Again, I think we mentioned last time that Israel or Israelite takes the place in the dictionary of the Maskilim. It takes the place of Jew, which has again a kind of negative connotation to it. So, in order to educate the youths of Israel in the proper manner, two types of studies should be established. The first type is the study of human knowledge, what he calls Torat Ha'adam, what I just kind of described in this term of secular studies. That is, those matters which earn for their possessors the title man, Adam, since he who lacks this knowledge hardly deserves this title, as shall be explained. The second type is the study of the Torah of God. That is, God's laws and teachings, matters that are above human reason and that are made known to Moses through prophetic revelation. Had the Torah not come to us in this divine fashion, it would have remained hidden from even the most sagacious of men, for its contents cannot be deduced from the fixed laws of nature. Moreover, only the seed of Israel is obligated in the laws of Torah. So he makes this point that there are two realms of knowledge. There's Torah Adam, which helps us attain a certain status in this world with our fellow men, with the society, the larger society in which we live. And then there's also Torah Hashem. There's the Torah of God, the study of Torah, which that's a matter of prophecy and revelation. And without prophecy and revelation, we would never get to that knowledge. Now, that's a question. I mean, he's taking a stand on something that the Gemara and Rav Sadia Gaon and others have discussed about the degree to which the parts of the Torah are intuitive, or parts of the Torah we might learn in other ways. But the essential bulk of what Torah is a revelation. Even the ideas that we might have come to on our own, like don't kill, don't steal, things that most societies tend to also arrive at without the benefit of revelation, but nevertheless, these are all products of God's revealed will. And without God's revealed will, we wouldn't possess them, we wouldn't have them. But Torah Adam, those are the things that that we get to through the conventions of society and civilization. And he is about to point out that we've been a little remiss in that the Torah to Adam we haven't really studied. He says here, let me just skip ahead. Here, therefore, he who lacks human knowledge, even though he has learned the laws and teachings of God and lives according to them, gives no pleasure to others. And this for two reasons. If you're lacking in secular studies, even though you might know Torah, you're missing something. What are you missing? Well, first, his fellowship is burdensome to other people, meaning his involvement in the larger society is there's going to be a lack. His speech in worldly affairs will not be in conformity with reason, and his actions worse than useless, for they will be of no benefit and no service to other people. Second, even though the laws and teachings of God are far superior to human knowledge, they are closely correlated to it. Where human knowledge ends, the divine teaching begins, instructing us on what is beyond man's power of reason. Therefore, he who is ignorant of the laws of God, but is versed in human knowledge, even though the sages of Israel will not benefit from his... Let me turn the page. From his light in the study of Torah, he will benefit the remainder of humanity. But he who is ignorant of human knowledge, though he knows the laws of God, gladdens neither the wise of his own people nor the remainder of humanity. So he says there's a symbiotic relationship between these things. Torah to Adam might be a type of necessary precursor to the more significant Torah of God, because it helps you function in this world. And since the Torah of God is also meant to say something about our condition here, you need certain qualities and certain attitudes and certain knowledge sets which a little bit of secular studies is going to help you out with. Right, so obviously it's based upon the notion that there's benefit to being part of the wider society. And here's correct, although he's going to make an argument for why it's going to be necessary and why it's actually part of, in other words, he's making an argument for why the status quo of a type of Jewish isolation is really the abnormality, is really the, through no fault of our own. I'm gonna skip ahead. He says, let it be understood, however, that we ourselves are not responsible for this state of affairs. We should not pour out our anger upon ourselves or direct our complaints against ourselves. He's making a caveat. He's saying, to be clear, we live in a very distorted kind of existence. Jewish existence, as it currently is, here it is, mid-18th century, it's all distorted. But that's not our fault. Rather, it's the nations who have hosted us for more than 1,000 years who are to blame for our misfortune. For they have terribly wronged us by the command of their kings and ministers. Inspired by many evil motives, they have risen against us to destroy us and to humble us to the dust, for which purpose they subjected us to irrational decrees. They thereby acted contrary to human knowledge, for they thrust our bodies to the dust and depressed the spirit within us. As he's saying that Judaism was never opposed to general study, to general wisdom. Could you, let me just grab a book. Where is it? The Green Book, the J.J. Schechter volume. There's an interesting book called Judaism's... Alan, are you with us? Maybe you can Google it. Edited by Rabbi Jacob J. Schechter. The book is called Judaism's Encounter with Other Cultures. I think that's what it is. If you can put up the link to it, that'd be useful. It's a survey. It's four different essays, but it's a survey of Judaism's encounter with general wisdom, with general studies in the classical period, the medieval period, and the modern period. And then Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein kind of wrote an overview essay about what encounter with general wisdom contributes to the religious life. I would also mention Rabbi Norman Lamb's book, Torah Umada. It's a book in English. I mentioned to you a couple of sessions ago his book, Torah Lishma, about Reb Chaim Volozhiner. This is a book called Torah Umada, which is a survey of different classical ways in which Jewish culture and general studies have interacted, from an integrationist approach to a rejectionist approach and everything in between. I think Rabbi Lamb has six different models for how Jewish and general culture, Jewish and general knowledge, have interacted over the years. But the way things are in Europe in mid-18th century, there's an almost complete breakdown. And Wiesel is saying, don't hide behind the notion that this is the traditional way. It's the chicken and the egg. It's the chicken and the egg. What's this other? Yeah, it's the chicken and the egg. In other words, this Jewish isolation and this Jewish rejection of general studies, of secular knowledge and wisdom, that's just because that's the way the non-Jews have isolated us. And then we've turned it into an ideology. But really, that's not what Judaism is. That's not what Judaism is all about. He has this critique, just to go back for a second, where he, in other words, again, I'm doing it backwards. I told you the caveat here where he says it's not our fault, but what is going on? So he says there's one people in the world who are not sufficiently concerned with human knowledge and who have neglected the public institution of their youth and the laws of etiquette, the sciences and the arts. We, the children of Israel, dispersed throughout all of Europe, who live in most of its states, have turned our backs on these studies. Those among us who dwell in Germany and Poland have been especially negligent in this regard. Jews that lived in Sephardic lands, were always more worldly than the Rambam. But of course, the Rambam lived 600 years earlier. Seven hundred years earlier, but in the Sephardic lands there was always a little more integration. So he says we, particularly in Germany and Poland, we've been especially negligent in this regard. Many among them, meaning he's talking about us, many among us are men of intelligence and great understanding, and many are also men of faith and piety. But from childhood, their exclusive preoccupation has been God's laws and teachings. They have not heard or studied human knowledge. They are ignorant even of the grammar of the Holy Tongue. And here's an irony, of course, in other words, because Hebrew is, of course, central to Jewish studies, but only functionally. To study grammar, to study diktuk, to study lashon, was not part of the traditional curriculum. So even the study of Hebrew has been neglected. There's a contradiction here, because Joseph II was calling basically for the abolition of Hebrew, but really he was talking about Yiddish, because people didn't really communicate in Hebrew, although some wrote in it, and knowledgeable people were literate in Hebrew, at least passively literate in Hebrew, but Joseph II's real problem is with Yiddish, but he does mention Hebrew. And here, Wiesel is making an argument for a return to Hebrew, and he himself contributed greatly to the revival of Hebrew. And then he goes on to make a program for a return to the study of general wisdom and of general culture. I'm skipping ahead greatly, and I do encourage you to download this from the website and to read it on your own. But he makes this point here. Again, this is by way of caveat. He says, it is, however, thus a source of thorough amazement how, in spite of all the evil that's befallen us, we've remained a people, and how, notwithstanding the flow of mighty waters, we have nevertheless retained our humanity. It's the, and here again, he's a maskil of the old sort, like Mendelssohn. He himself is traditional, but he's making an argument that he knows is going to be rejected by the traditionalists, and he's I'm not sure. He wants to have his cake and eat it too. I'm not sure about that. I don't think we have to be so. We don't have to be so so critical. He realizes he's trying to make an argument. He's trying to be persuasive, and he has to anticipate the critique that he's going to withstand. So he says, "Look, it's remarkable that despite the condition we've been held in, what we've achieved throughout all these many years of diaspora. It's the power of the divine Torah that is responsible for this. I have no reason to assume that he's not being sincere here. Despite our lack of all the above-mentioned knowledge, the Torah stood by us and assured us of a human heart. Vehi she'amdo lavoteinu v'lanu. Right? Protecting us thereby from the trait of cruelty, from the truly evil actions. Far be these sins from us. From the days of yore until now, we were never in a rebellious association or in a wicked band who devised evil against men. In every generation, we were faithful to the kings ruling over us and to the inhabitants of the land." He's also, of course, this element might have another, even though he's writing in Hebrew to other Jews, there is a sense that somebody's looking in on what's being said. So there is this sense of saying, you know, we've always been loyal, we've always been good, we've never rebelled. "If we found ourselves in the humblest of stations, we consoled ourselves with the thought of our innocence, and we said, these are the prejudices in the hearts of the people and their rulers who are acting in the tradition of their fathers. And we hoped God would change their hearts toward us for the good and find mercy in their eyes," etc., etc., etc. Again, let me just skip ahead to the last page. "However, to everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven." He says, look, we were held in a very difficult position. We were oppressed. Somehow we managed to keep our heads above water. But to everything there's a season and a time for every purpose under the heaven. L'chol zman ve'et, he's quoting here from Qohelet. "From the time the Creator, blessed be He, established heaven and earth, He ordered in His superior wisdom the appointed times of the universe, times of good and times of evil. For He proclaims the generations from the beginning and sees them to the end of all existence. From generation to generation, knowledge that was hidden was revealed by wise men in the arts, sciences, and crafts, such as the discovery of America, the invention of printing, gunpowder, spectacles, and so forth." He's making a historiosophic point. He says, look, God knows everything and can do everything and guides history. So why didn't he make it that when they leave the Garden of Eden, they knew about America and they had technology and they had the printing press and they had penicillin and they had electricity? And I'm updating the question. And the internet. How come they didn't have what did they need Volusian for when they could have had the web yeshiva? Right? So why is it that technology, you know, kind of reveals itself? So he's making a point that that's the way history unfolds and unravels. It's always becoming more sophisticated. It's always attaining a greater achievement. And so too, here, let's again just skip ahead. So too. Oh, and so now, perhaps the time has come to remove hatred from the hearts of men, an unfounded hatred based on a quarrel which is not theirs and whose source lies in differences of faith and worship. So he says, just like there's this evolutionary movement, once upon a time, you know, if you got sick, you died. And now we have medicine, and now we have science, and now we know about things we didn't know about before. So maybe the world will outgrow its prejudices against the Jewish people. Now, in this, perhaps he was being naive. But you have seen that God is good. He has raised up a great man, a savior to mankind, the exalted emperor, His Majesty Joseph II. Aside from the tidings of his wisdom, his counsel, and his military might, imperial statements that have recently issued from him, meaning the Edict of Tolerance, have brought us tidings of even more heroic deeds. These statements, words of peace and truth to all his subjects. So there's the title, the Divrei Shalom Ve'emet. What are the words of peace and truth? No, what are the words of the peace and truth? Correct. They are the Edict of Tolerance. The edict, similar to the edict issued in the days of Achashverosh, the words of peace and truth are, the Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, is the Edict of Tolerance. They have been tried in the crucible of reason and are founded on the love of mankind. Moreover, in his many good works, he has not forgotten a poor people long abused, the Jews. So he says, look, in other words, Joseph II, he might be an agent of Hashkacha. He might be an agent of the way history is supposed to unfold. And that unfolding of history, we believe, is going to be favorable to the Jewish people. So it behooves us to pay attention to it. He does point out that, in other words, he's trying to permit us to engage in all forms of cultivation of the land, to work the crafts, to engage in trade, which is, of course, motivated by an economic self-interest on his part. But it's also in our economic self-interest. It's also in our economic self-interest. In his interest, he's also observed that few among us speak the German language accurately, and as a result cannot read books, neither history books nor books on etiquette, science, the arts. Neither can we speak in a clear fashion with the inhabitants of the land and their ministers. If we want to get integrated into the larger national economy, we're going to have to learn to speak German. There's just no two ways about that. They're not going to learn how to speak Yiddish. Taking this into consideration, he has commanded us upon a righteous path. He has instructed the Jews to establish schools in which to teach their children to read and write the German language. He's also instructed them to write edifying books about the Torah, to teach the children understanding and the rules of behavior in society, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, history, geography, whatever the curriculum was in 18th century Germany. However, these are to be studied from extant books used by children of the kingdom. Because if you're going to go to school, you're going to have to learn German. Knowledge of these subjects can only strengthen the house of Israel. And here's his point. We have nothing to fear. We have nothing to fear. Becoming integrated in the general society can only help us. It can only mend the breaches made by the preceding rulers, right? The repair to what Jewish society looks like, or the changes that will come about in Jewish society, he's making an argument, is a case of, these are not his words, but a kind of Chadesh Yameinu Kikedem. It's scary, it's threatening to change the way we kind of view ourselves and organize ourselves. But really, he's saying, we're returning to a more authentic Judaism. The way things are now is not as they ought to be, but the way they have evolved because of our miserable situation. So to turn back the tide is really to be returning to the source. And thus the children of Israel will also be men who accomplish worthy things, assisting the king's country in their actions, labor, and wisdom. This is classic Haskalah. This is the agenda of the Enlightenment. Perhaps, again, like we said about Mendelssohn last week, perhaps there's a naivete at work. But it's not the kind of, with a kind of cynical paintbrush, we paint them as being evil. I don't see that. I don't read that. That's not what comes off the page here. that doesn't mean it necessarily has the desired effect or result, as we'll have to see in our following session. So again, next time we'll continue, but next week, which is the last week of this semester, I'll be teaching at 10 o'clock Israel time, but if you are changing your clock on this Motzei Shabbat, this Saturday night, you'll be 1 hour closer to me. So it will be 1 hour later than usual for you. And if you're not at all clear about that, send an email to me or to the office, and someone will help you figure out exactly when and where it is. Where it is in the ether of the internet. When it is, it'll be an hour later than usual if you are changing your clock this week. Laila Tov, or Boker Tov, depending on where you are. Of course. I can't hear you, Sherry. Say again. Rav Kook? No, I think this is way too early for Rav Kook. No, I mean there are 10 other links in the chain before we get to Rav Kook. So I mean, he's influenced in the sense that, you know, in the links of history, everything's touching each other. But no, but it's just. I don't know whether or not he personally would have read this piece, but I mean, but the idea is that this is the first volley. Yeah. Okay. Yes, Chaim, you had a question. Chaim, can you speak up? I can't. Yeah, I think that, and as he doesn't quote that, it's surprising that he wouldn't quote that. But there are all types of quotes that he could make from the Rambam, from the Mishneh Torah, from elsewhere, from that Mishnah in Avot, which clearly show that the Jewish tradition favors a certain engagement with general studies, with general knowledge, and with going out and working. Now, again, they weren't studying in Kollel. That's not what we're talking about. But Jews obviously did have to earn a living. They didn't always do so well. There was rampant poverty, which was also a problem and was also something that isolated them from a more general cultured society. But they occupied a very, very, very small niche of professions, including money lending, which obviously made them not such palatable figures in the eyes of European society. There's a reason that Shylock becomes the symbol and the caricature that he does of the Jew. And the argument is that if we can expand out through knowledge, through education, into other fields, that will enhance our situation, it will enhance the universal image of the Jew, etc. It's interesting that he doesn't, you know, make that argument from those other sources. But some of those are discussed in these other books that I referenced, Rabbi Lamb's book and the volume edited by J.J. Schechter. Okay. Okay, good night. Roxanne, is it very cold there? You look like you're very cold.